WCHD 3 Detroit, KMPS HD 3 Seattle, WBMX HD 3 Boston,
and on AOL Radio
and Yahoo Launchcast. CBS Radio's The New Sky, New Horizons, No Boundaries.
Back to Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy Duterte.
You're hot and you're cold. Yes, and you're low. You're in and you're out. You're up and you're down.
Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-SOUL.
Welcome in, everyone, over at New Sky Radio and the Para-X Network. It is Hot Leads Cold Cases with your host, Nancy Duterte. Now, each week here on the show, we bring you a new and fascinating guest. This week, of course, is no exception. We'll let Nancy get into that in just a moment. But you can reach us with a question or a comment throughout the show, 248-545-7685. Again, the phone number is 248-545-SOUL. If you can't call in, we've got a couple of online options for you as well. Here at the Sky, newskyradio.com, look for the instant feedback right there on the homepage. And for anyone listening over at the Para-X side of things, you can always use the chat room for a quick question or comment. And of course, keep in mind, you can find our host Nancy away from the show. Just make sure you find her at theskepticalpsychic.com. So we'll find out what's in store for you tonight. Send it over to your host, Nancy Duterte.
All right. Thank you, Brandon. It occurs to me, you know, I don't often do this, but I have decided to kind of switch my interview around. I'm going to flip it backwards because it occurs to me that I think half the country tomorrow is going to be under some kind of pretty massive snowstorm if they haven't already. I think it's already, you might already be having it in Detroit, Brandon. Are you under,
later tonight?
Later tonight, yeah. And I think we're at New Jersey, the East Coast, we're going to get it tomorrow. But a lot of states are going to be blanketed with pretty amazing weather. And my guest tonight has actually done some lectures and talked about, of all things, the relationship between artificially manufactured weather and the interest of UFOs around those events. And I think that's just really fascinating. So we're going to talk to him about that. And he also happens to be one of the most respected ufologists in the country. He actually made his reputation in the UFO field, writing the first authoritative book on a very important UFO incident that occurred in England back in 1980 at the twin RAF or Royal Air Force bases of Bentwaters and Woodbridge. The book is it was a highly acclaimed British bestseller. It's called Left at Eastgate, a firsthand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. And it was first published in 1997. Peter Robbins, who is my guest, co-wrote this really excellent account of this military UFO encounter that occurred in England. With Larry Warren, who is a member of the U.S. Air Force Security Police, or was stationed at this, Americanized base on British soil. The Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, or sometimes known as the Bentwaters case, is sort of also known as the British Roswell, because that it really broke the whole UFO reality wide open. The incident itself, I'm not going to go into it too much. It occurred over two or three days right after Christmas. It involved numerous U.S. personnel who reported sightings of unexplained lights zooming around. They were splitting into multiple different colored lights. There were pillars of lights being beamed down to the ground from these craft. Some of them beamed onto weapons storage facilities. They even talked about a landing of a triangular-shaped craft that was apparently covered in some type of hieroglyphics on the exterior. So there are all kinds of really wild accounts that happened. Dozens of U.S. Air Force personnel were eyewitnesses to various events over this period of time. And amid reports of military threats to enforce secrecy, only a few actually went on record to talk about what happened. And my guest, Peter Robbins, co-author, Larry Warren, was one of them. So we're going to be talking to Peter also about his impressions of what happened, what's true, what's not, and what's being said about that whole thing now. A little background on Peter. He comes to this field kind of with an unusual background. He received his BFA degree in painting and film history from the School of Visual Arts in New York. He worked as a studio artist in off-Broadway theater as a house manager. He apparently had some repressed UFO memories from childhood that came back to him, and his career took a very interesting turn. He then became an investigative writer, author, lecturer on the topic of UFOs. He also worked with famed UFO investigator Bud Hopkins for several years. He's a regular contributor to the British UFO Truth magazine, and he's currently working on an independent film, which is going to be about possible UFO and or human bases, I believe, on the dark side of the moon. So with that big introduction, I hope you're still there, Peter.
I am, actually.
Okay, good. I want to start off talking about something really interesting that you have started lecturing about and writing about recently, and it has to do with a guy who was an early 20th century psychoanalyst. His name was Wilhelm Reich. And I only ever heard that name because I got certified in intuitive gestalt psychotherapy. So I know that he influenced that movement of gestalt psychotherapy. He was an associate of Sigmund Freud. He had some kind of pretty interesting and pretty weird obsessions, I think, with sexual energy. He coined the term, I'm not going to pronounce this right, it's orgone energy?
Orgone.
Orgone, all right. And he believed that was a type of a cosmic energy. He believed it could cure cancer and schizophrenia. He created these sort of Faraday cages, and he called them orgone accumulators. Even tried to get Einstein interested in his inventions. So he's kind of he's a real fascinating guy. Anyway, he apparently, at a certain point in his career, around in the 1950s, he said he had discovered something called deadly orgone radiation. And he believed this caused the creation of deserts. So he created cloud-busting machines. And he then, well, you know what? I'm not even going to get into the relationship of that and UFOs yet. Maybe for our listeners, explain what these cloud-busting machines were. And I believe you've seen them in action. Is that right?
Yes. Let me take it back further than that, because hearing you give that description was just a reminder to me of how absolutely mad all of this sounds. This is not something that I've gotten into recently, Nancy. I gave my first lecture on Reich's work in the early 1980s. I was a patient in therapy with Dr. Reich's first assistant for the last 11 years of his life when I was in my 30s, and the value of that to me was really beyond compare. Reich's work, his science, which really is about how energy functions, is actually incredibly logical, and because it deals with energy function, weaves its way through all branches of the natural sciences. He was a brilliant physician who studied in Austria, graduated from medical school in the early 1920s, and was, like so many other bright medical people, drawn to the work of Dr. Freud. He went on to become not an associate of Freud's, but Freud's first assistant. And they went their separate ways in 1929 after a disagreement. Reich was not obsessed with human sexuality, but unlike Freud, who felt that many, if not most, human neuroses, dysfunctions, pathologies were rooted in sexual problems, Reich felt literally all human neuroses, no matter how disguised in other functions, had a basis in sexual dysfunction, hence their split. His work on the study of how energy functions in the living and non-living realms took him through everything again, from human neuroses to cancer formation to the way that star systems form in the cosmos, to the way that storms form on Earth, to the dynamic of childbirth and child raising, to socio-political pathologies and psychology. And by the early 1950s, he developed a device in his laboratory setting in southern Maine, in Rangeley, Maine, which he called a cloudbuster. And the simplest way I can explain the principle is there's a drawing principle going on here. When I was a boy growing up in Queens, New York, my Russian grandmother, if myself or my sisters or any of my cousins developed a boil or a pimple or something, her way of addressing it was you would cut a potato in half and you would hold the potato to the wound. All I knew as a kid was that it felt better, the same way that when I got a little bit older and I was a Boy Scout, we were taught that if you're stung by a bee, you pack mud onto it. And on the surface, it seems just like the coolness of the mud makes that wound feel better. But in both cases, the living energy in that mud or in that potato is drawing the toxins to the surface, which creates a crisis, so to say, in that wound so that it breaks quicker and heals at a livelier pace. And the Cloudbuster was simply, very simply, a set of long metal pipes which were attached to hollow industrial BX cable. The cable was grounded in water, either a deep well or moving water. And the water literally acted as a ground, and it drew the energy in the atmosphere down and created movement in the atmosphere. He first experimented with this during a drought in southern Maine in the early 1950s, and within a matter of a few short weeks, that drought had broken specifically in that area of southern Maine. It was so dramatic that they decided to do field tests in the most arid part of the United States that they could find, which at the time was in an area outside of, not Phoenix, Tucson, Arizona, where it had not rained more than half an inch or so in 5 years. And after less than 2 months of weather modification work, they broke every single record for rain in the history of the state of Arizona. Now, this is compressing the story greatly, where we enter into it in terms of UFO studies is wild as it sounds. And this was multiply witnessed, documented, photographed, etc. This cloud modification work attracted UFO activity.
Okay. Now, he called this... Well, okay, so maybe explain, it's going to be better if you explain it,
mm-hmm.
why this particular transaction of energy, okay, changing the weather, modifying the weather with these cloud-busting machines, why that was attracting UFOs, and what happened to those UFOs that were attracted?
Mm-hmm. Well, number one, I don't know because I wasn't on the UFOs. I didn't make that decision. We can make very educated guesses, though. There was something about the energetic.
Peter, let me introduce. Sorry to. I jumped the gun a little bit here. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, I think that's it'd be better because I know that's going to be a little bit of an extended answer, and I got to take a quick. Everybody, stay with us. My guest tonight is Peter Robbins, and you're listening to Hot Leads Cold Cases.
At Talent, our family treasure, we create dolls, jewelry, eggs, and decorations. We believe in beauty and kindness beyond measure. At Talent, our family treasure. Shop at talentoft.com or find us on amazon.com. At Talent, our family treasure.
For a second there, I thought you disappeared. Rains a lot this time of year. And we both go together if one falls down. I talk out loud like you're still around. Suitcase. I love you, standing all alone in a black.
Tonight I think I'll be staying here. And you never did like this town. I talk out loud like you're still around.
Radio's The New Sky. The Sky.
We're back. This is Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy Duterte. Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-7685.
And we're back with Hot Leads, Cold Cases here at The Sky and the Para-X Network. Very happy to be joined tonight by our guest, Peter Robbins. And if you had any questions for Nancy and Peter, go ahead and give us a call. We've got open lines right now at 248-545-7685. Again, 248-545-SOUL. You can also send instant feedback at New Sky Radio right there on the homepage. Type out your question or comment. We'll address it live on air just as if it were a phone call. Similarly, with the chat room over at Para-X. So we'd like to hear from you. If you had any questions or comments, that's how you can get a hold of us. And with all that said, we'll get things back over to Nancy and Peter.
All right. Thanks, Brandon. So I got so excited I lost all track of time. So sorry about that. I did interrupt you, and I probably now have gotten so excited I've forgotten what my original question was. But we were talking about Wilhelm Reich, who was a psychoanalyst. He developed these cloud-busting machines that consisted, if you see pictures of them, they're pretty impressive looking. They got these 15-foot-long aluminum pipes. They're attached onto a mobile platform. They kind of look like a military, like a gunning, I don't know the terms, but, you know, like a one of those guns that you turn around and you shoot them off into the sky. But you say that you've actually witnessed these machines in action, and they actually modified the weather. So maybe talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I had one experience, and it was a demonstration that was arranged for individuals like myself who are working as volunteers to raise funds for what is now a college just outside of Princeton, New Jersey, which is devoted to replicating the discoveries and experiments of Dr. Reich. It's called the American College of Orgonomy. And they had arranged for, I don't know, 15 or 20 of us to observe how these cloudbusters work. The one that we were involved with was mounted on the back of a pickup truck. And it was a good-sized machine. As you said, it does have a vague resemblance to kind of an anti-aircraft kind of gun. It's got a number of long metallic tubes, often eight over eight, two rows of them. And each tube, the back of it, is connected to a piece of industrial BX cable, a fairly long one. Now, this is the kind of cable, a scaled-up version, that snakes its way through the walls of our homes. But all of the wiring is pulled out of these. It's so deceptively simple that people have attacked it, its veracity, simply because they feel it couldn't work because it is so simple. But again, the principle is sound. The cables were thrown into a large pond that was on this property in rural New Jersey, not that far from where the college was. And the operator who was working with this device on a long kind of remote control cable, they do put off a certain toxicity when they're working. And the first thing he said was he directed our attention to a bank of cumulus clouds in the sky. And he said, I'm going to train the pipes on that cloud bank, and I'm going to cut it in half. After that, I'm going to do this. I'm going to rearrange that cloud bank. I'm going to remove these clouds from over here. And in a matter of an incredibly short time, Nancy, maybe 2 minutes or so, once the pipes were on it, that cloud bank began to separate into two parts. And I have a very clear memory of seeing what I can only describe as a number of jagged holes develop along the center of that cloud bank before it literally split into two. He went on to, again, this was purely for the sake of demonstration, and it lasted 20 minutes or half an hour or so. And I had studied this for 10 years before this. I accepted it in principle. I had read accounts of a number of individuals working with Reich, giving independent verification to operations they had observed in rural Maine and outside of Tucson in the 1950s. But you know the feeling. It is one thing to accept the certain scientific principles. It's another thing to see it in action. And it was one of the most memorable days of my adult life, no question about it.
And it obviously was not anything that looked coincidental, or, you know, clouds change, the winds change, all that kind of stuff.
No, and that's a fair question. In fact, you remind me that when I informed a number of my friends that I was going to be appearing on a radio show with a host who billed herself as a skeptic, they got very protective of me. And I said, no, you don't understand. We all, especially those of us who are deeply involved in research of anomalous subjects, we have to be the best, most voracious, most committed skeptics. Because the moment that we start to simply accept, say, the next UFO case is valid without taking it down to the best baseline and reinvestigating it, is the moment you really need to hand in your credentials. Belief, even if you know something is real, is never a substitute for careful reinvestigation in every new incident. So, yes, you're more than – that's a very welcome question indeed.
You have to, because, I mean, crazy is crazy, and you know, stuff that's can appear crazy sometimes is the most genius stuff of all. And this guy was right up there on the fringe, if you want my opinion. This guy was a real – I mean, I've taken a look at his life story. It's he lived a crazy life. Anyway, well, but it was interesting, and I want to get to this just before we run out of time, but it, from about early 1954, he apparently came to believe that Earth was being attacked by UFOs. He called them energy alphas, and he used to see them flying over his home in Maine. He said they were shaped like little thin cigars, and he said they were leaving streams of black, deadly orgone radiation in their wake. So he thought that they were scattering this around to destroy our planet. So he then decided he would stay up at night, you know, looking for these UFOs, and then he would bring out the cloud busters to try and, I guess, sort of suck out all of this bad, deadly orgone radiation. And I just think it's a very bizarre story, but it apparently had very real results.
Yes, and Nancy, the way that you express it is a bit of a caricature. Dr. Reich was an extremely knowledgeable scientist who worked for more than 40 years, kept scrupulous record, worked in a strictly classical method. And, you know, as they say, you don't have to be paranoid to know that someone is following you. These objects, these unidentified flying objects, when they appeared, the relative humidity in the air, the percentage of moisture, literally plummeted. This happened and was charted very carefully in both Maine and Arizona during experiments. At one point in the Arizona experiments, and this was not Dr. Reich as much as Dr. Reich and all of the individuals working with him, as well as independent meteorologists in the Tucson area, at one point, the humidity was up to 67%, something that was unheard of in the Tucson area. And UFOs began to appear in the skies above where they're doing their work, about 10 miles outside of Tucson. And the relative humidity in the air dropped 20% within an hour or so. And it happened repeatedly. So I know how this sounds. Again, this is a subject that has had my attention and careful study for me for over 40 years. I got involved when I was a teenager, and I was very fortunate in the years that I got to work with Dr. Baker to interview and spend time with many people, many of them gone now, who worked with Reich, studied with Reich, were students of his, etc.
Okay, but Reich thought that this was a full-scale interplanetary battle. Now, what are your thoughts about that? Did you ever get any impressions?
Oh, yeah. Now, again, there were several specific incidents that he characterized as that, to say that he felt that the UFO phenomena was a full-scale interplanetary battle is sort of feeding the fire of sensationalism. There is no question in my mind that a number of the operations in Tucson in 1954, where they were working very hard with two cloudbusters for, I think, almost 2 months to create rain, and a major rain. And again, they broke every existing weather record in the history of meteorology in that part of the country. When the humidity in the air was raised to such a point that prairie grass was starting to grow spontaneously out of the desert sand within an acre or so of where they were doing the cloud busting less than a week before it actually started to rain, which bespeaks a tremendous amount of moisture in the air. I mean, it's worth moments of consideration. But he came in over that area en masse. And one of the things that he did that sounds absolutely as dramatic as it can, and it was he trained the cloudbusters directly on these anomalous objects in the air repeatedly. And we have account after account of the objects wobbling, fading in color, dissipating, disappearing, flying off, etc., in every incidence where this energetic device was trained on them. Now, the main thing that I think we can deduce from that is, at least in these cases, there was something about their power source or modus operandi that interacted with, conflicted with, was related to the energetic functioning of these cloud-busting devices.
That's exactly what I wanted to get to, because that's sort of the key piece of this whole thing. We got to take another quick break.
Yep.
We're going to talk about that just briefly when we get back, because that is something I want to get your opinion on. You're listening to Hot Leads Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Peter Robbins.
Enlighten, empower, enrich. This is CBS Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries. We'll be right back.
path. More clouds appear till the sky went black. And there was no sunlight, no sunlight. And there was no sunlight, no sunlight anymore. It disappeared at the same speed. The idealistic things I believe. The optimist died inside.
CBS Radio's The New Sky. The Sky.
We're back. This is Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy Duterte.
One thing leads to another.
Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-7685. Believe.
And we're back. It's the halfway point of the show, Hot Leads, Cold Cases, here at the Sky, New Horizons, No Boundaries, and the Para-X Network. We are joined tonight by our guest, Peter Robbins. Still plenty of time for a question or a comment for Nancy and Peter at 248-545-7685. Online, you've got a few options. If you're at the Para-X Network listening, you can send a question or comment via the chat room. Of course, over here at New Sky Radio, we've got the instant feedback right there on the homepage of our website. Remember, you can find Nancy away from the show. Make sure you find her at theskepticalpsychic.com. So, with that said, send things right back over to Nancy and Peter.
All right. Well, I'm just going to go for the $64,000 question here, Peter. I hope you don't mind. But so we're talking about Wilhelm Reich's cloud-busting equipment and how he actually used to train it in the direction of UFOs that were flying around because he thought UFOs were a bad thing and that they were sort of, I don't know, dispersing this sort of bad type of cosmic energy radiation. So he would shoot this thing in their direction and they would wobble around and disappear, or they seem to have problems. And apparently I think you've written that our government, the U.S. government, and possibly the British government, have gotten involved in using these types of machines in some type of in a military capacity against UFOs. And first of all, is that true? Second of all, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, no, it's not true the way you say it. In the course of researching the Rendlesham Forest incident, I made my first of what's now more than 20 visits back to the United Kingdom in February of 1988 with my co-author, Larry Warren, who had been stationed there as an Air Force security police officer in 1980. And we arrived back in Suffolk, England, about 5 months after a freak storm of absolutely extraordinary proportions, unlike any storm that had ever been charted or recorded in the history of British meteorology and weather keeping, had hit that part of the country. It had taken down something like 1.3 million mature evergreen trees in the course of 2 hours without a drop of rain and with winds that were estimated at about 100 miles an hour, which cannot be accurate. I was extraordinarily, we were both very upset seeing this tremendous carnage. And shortly before we left, Larry saw his first photograph that I had had in the house of a cloudbuster and said very casually, is this one of those cloudbusters that you had talked about? And I said, yeah. He said, we had one of these on base. It was just much, much larger. And it was painted olive drab, mounted on a flatbed trailer and over by one of the flight lines. And I actually got quite angry at him and accused him of, exaggerating or misidentifying an object. And he came right back at me and he said, no. I said, well, it would have had to have had these long flexible pipes off the back. They had them. Well, you would have had to have wells in the area. He said, they're all over the place on that part of the base, which they were. I had an opportunity to see them shortly after for the first time. And I was probably the only person that would have put this together, having observed them in action, having studied Reich's work for many years before that. But even so, even with the not just the level of number of trees, we actually saw holly trees that were more than 500 years old, some of them a meter across at the base, that were snapped or split open, something that defies any kind of logic of a normal meteorological crisis. In any case, I knew how this would sound. It sounds ludicrous enough when you put the question to me. At the same time, I know that Reich, because he wrote about it in detail, had forwarded schematics of these devices to offices within the United States government, including the United States Air Force, hoping that they might be used to decrease the size of deserts or to interact with storms in a positive manner. And all I could think was, my God, did the Air Force ever actually build these things? But we're certainly not going to mention this in our book with just one witness and anecdotal material, even though it's fascinating. And it was about 2 years later that we had two more independent, absolutely honorably retired United States Air Force personnel say, oh, yes, they remembered the exact same devices in the exact same location at about the same scale. And at that point, I thought, my God, I have three witnesses now, none of whom are backing down, none of whom have any angle here or, you know, issue to try to make a point on. And so we did publish around that. And I informed a colleague of mine, Dr. James DeMeo, shortly before the book went to press. And Jim, who operates cloud-busting devices and has broken droughts around the world on contract with different governments, waited until the book came out to confirm that he had information that a similar destructive incident took place not that long before the one that I had described, in the same proximity of an American base in West Germany at the time, and another one. I think that there is cause to feel, or at least deduce, that it's not out of the question that, yes, at least on this base, they had one of these devices. Whether or not there were more of them that were produced by the United States government or the Air Force, I have no idea. And I have no information that the British replicated this. It was simply a situation that took place on British soil.
So if we in fact have these kinds of devices around, and if they're not being used for, you know, the militarization of weather modification, mm-hmm. then I guess maybe there's a good chance they're being used against UFOs.
Well, once again, that's purely theoretical. At no point in the account in our book, in Left at Eastgate, is this even speculated on. For me, the fact that the UFOs are kind of a common functioning aspect of the story of cloud-busting technology is interesting, but I am very careful not to take a deduction beyond a deduction and make a conclusion based on it. So your guess is as good as mine, Nancy, as far as that goes.
All right, fair enough. Well, you know, I do want to, because you are the expert on the Renderson Forest UFO incident, and I do want to talk to you about it. I know that there's a new book that is scheduled to come out, I believe, in April.
That's right.
That is a sort of a co-written between Nick Pope and, let's see, John Burroughs and Jim Pendleton. Is that correct?
Pendleton, correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they have apparently a slightly different take on the entire incident. And I know that they've not been wonderful in supporting your co-author, who was also a witness and was there during the incident, Larry Warren. And I think what's so curious about this whole thing is that there are, I don't know how you sort anything out anymore, because it seems to me that the truth of what actually happened that those couple of nights when the men on that military base went out to investigate these strange incidents, it's been sort of a sea of concealed truths, things that people can't say but want to say but don't say but later say. And it's very, very difficult to figure out, you know, what's what and who's who in this game. What do you think is going to be their position, you know, with regard to the way that you have explained what happened that night?
Well, I have to say, first of all, you're very genteel in the way that you couch your words. They don't disagree. They have viciously attacked my co-author's account of things. And the fact is, neither of them were involved in the incident that he was involved in. Neither of them were there on that night as well. John and Dim are indeed fully authentic witnesses, being involved on the very first night of events, and we're hoping to get their account written out finally and fully. And they're very fortunate to have Nick Pope writing this book with them helping him to do it. John was also involved at another time during the three nights of events, but they don't contest my co-author's event. They simply dismiss it as something that didn't happen, and don't bother them with the facts because they've made up their mind. There's a tremendous arrogance there, as far as I'm concerned, and a tremendous rigidity. Plus, Jim, on the 30th anniversary, and I mean very specifically the 30th anniversary of these events, when he and I and John, joined by Linda Howe and Nick Pope and Larry Warren, took part in a modest-sized event marking that 30th anniversary back on location in southern England, Jim Pendleton took that occasion to let the public know that when he touched that craft that they encountered on the first night, and I have no doubt that they did, a so-called binary code downloaded into his head of thousands of ones and zeros that he remembered very specifically, and he wrote page after page after page of ones and zeros, which are a message from the intelligences behind the event, and that will be presented after saying that the information would come out a number of times beforehand. That
yeah,
will,
I believe that they held up that information for quite a long time. For
well,
the
they've done it repeatedly.
But let me. Yeah. We got to take another quick break. So sorry, but I do want to talk to you about that when he touched the UFO and some of his impressions. When we come back, you're listening to Hot Leads Cold Cases. My guest tonight is Peter Robbins.
CBS Radio's The New Sky. New horizons, no boundaries. NewSkyRadio.com.
In a way, need a change from this burnout scene. Another time, another town, another everything. Always back to you. Stumbled out in the night under pouring rain. Made the block sad and thought there's more I need. It's always back. Yeah.
back to you. But I'm good without you. Yeah, I'm good without you.
Radio's The New Sky, New Horizons, No Boundaries.
Back to Hot Leads and Cold Cases with Nancy Duterte.
You're hot, then you're cold. Yes, then you're low. You're in, then you're out. You're up, then you're down.
Call Nancy Duterte now.
248-545-SOUL.
And we're back, Hot Leads, Cold Cases, here at The Sky and the Para-X Network. Now, it is our final segment. I do want to make sure everyone finds your host, Nancy, away from the show. Make sure you find her at theskepticalpsychic.com. So we're a bit short on time. Get things right back over to Nancy and Peter.
All right. Great. Thank you, Brandon. So we were talking before I so rudely cut you off again, but we were talking about this. It's sort of, almost a he said, she said situation. You've got your witness to the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. You co-wrote your book with Larry Warren. Now you've got Nick Pope coming out with his new book with John Burroughs and Jim Peniston. And they've got a different angle, apparently. And well, I find it so strange that, you know, people who have witnessed a UFO event would argue at all, because it would seem to me that they're all kind of on the same side, regardless of what the experience was. And from my knowledge of UFO experiences, they can be very odd and very peculiar. And same as in the paranormal world, some people may see the ghost, some might not. So people have different experiences of the same event. So I find it strange that they're arguing. But you were talking about when Jim actually touched the UFO craft, and he started getting this download of a binary code, and he's looking at hieroglyphics that are written into the side of the craft.
Yeah, first, it's not that they have a different version of the story. Their focus, as I understand it, will be on their experience, which was focused on the first night. Larry was involved on the third night, at an area and in a location that they were not. Yet they maintain that they know his event was not real because it doesn't fit the parameters of what they want to believe. Again, there's a tremendous intellectual arrogance as far as I'm concerned, and the fact is that Jim waited until the exact 30th anniversary of the event to mention in public that, oh, yes, one of the things that he learned with this download of binary code and remembering every single one of these thousands of ones and zeros in order and writing them into their book, which the deputy base commander, Charles I. Hall, who has seen that book, said he saw it early on and they were not there then. But Jim absolutely knows as empirical fact, he doesn't believe it, he doesn't think it, he doesn't wish it, or deduce it. He knows that the intelligences were time travelers from our future. For me, with all due respect, that's like saying, I have looked at the eyebrow of God and I can describe the shape to you. I don't know if you can know something like that. But what do I know? I've only been involved in this field for 37 years. Now, they maintain that they are going to prove this in their book. And I think that's going to be a reason to read that book, to see if or how they prove, and I use that with a capital P, that these intelligences were time travelers from our future. I know
You don't believe that time travel is possible?
It's not a matter of whether I believe it's possible or not. It's a matter of him saying that it was. These were time travelers from our future that were the cause of the events of December 1980 in Suffolk, England. That is a very different subject of what we believe. For him, it's simply empirical fact. I know from a post on a mutual friend site that he does not believe in evolution. He does not believe we came from monkeys. I don't know if he is strictly fundamentalist in his thinking, but for people who know, in quotes, that something is so, no matter what the historic evidence or fossil evidence or scientific evidence say, there really is no arguing with them. And woe to anyone that joins their Facebook page and disagrees with them. You will be removed as a member immediately. They don't take well to any conflicting opinions with those of their own. So we are in a problematic state here. Again, our book has been out since 1997. It took us almost 10 years to research it. I'm very proud of the fact that its 540 pages are a legitimate best-selling book in the United Kingdom. I stand behind everything that we wrote. It was updated and revised on the 25th anniversary of these events in 2005. We never attacked or questioned John and Jim's account, and they have come down like 10 tons on my co-author's honesty, veracity, sanity, my ethics as a researcher. So, that makes you go into a state of contention, no question about it. At the same time, I wish them well on the book and look forward to reading it when it comes out.
I think that we will all look forward to reading it when it comes out, because I think that anything that sheds any light on this very, very unusual case is going to be interesting. Just 2 seconds, I'm just curious, because I think one of the questions that always gets raised in these situations, particularly when the military is involved, is subsequent mind control, hypnosis. False memories being implanted. Are they saying that Larry was subject to that and therefore can't be believed?
Well, number one, they all admit, Larry, Jim, John, other key witnesses, that they were subjected to this. So they all have that issue going on in different ways, which adds to the complexity of the perceptions and the memories. Jim and John are still very clear that they have not fully remembered or resolved their memories. I was very physically close to Larry when he was going through his regression with Bud Hopkins, where he was finally brought back to these events and dealt with them in a straightforward and very courageous way. I've witnessed more hypnotic regressions than I can remember, but that was one of the most memorable of my life.
Yeah, it must have been fascinating. And you know what? I would love to have you come back and maybe talk a little bit in greater detail about that, but we're totally out of time, and we only have about 15 seconds left. If you want to let people know how they can get in touch with you and where they can buy your book, Left at Eastgate.
Sure. I'd be glad to come back, Nancy. The book is available at barnesandnoble.com, any good online store. If you friend me on Facebook, I'll be glad to arrange to send you an inscribed copy. I will have my website up and running again within the next 2 months. It will be peterrobbins.com. Otherwise, my public presence right now is on Facebook. Thank you so much for having me on as a guest, and I'll look forward to a return in the future.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much, Peter. I really appreciate it. Good night, everybody. We'll see you next week.